Let's go then to the final chapter of the unit, which means the examination one should be coming up. You should already know that by keeping a close eye on the schedule. This final chapter for the unit is all about the importance of carbon. We just got through with a chapter about the importance of water. Well, carbon is also important to life, as you know. And so this brings up kind of a tricky definition, which is organic. Now, chemistry as a science is immense. There are all kinds of corners in chemistry that are themselves big subsets of science. So, you know, when you're a chemist, you are not a chemist for all of chemistry. You specialize in one, just like biology. Biology is a pretty big science, too. Chemistry is immense, though. And it's so big that you can cut it into two still big subsciences called organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. And biology is really just a subset of inorganic chemistry when you talk about the chemistry of life. But this word is a little bit tricky. Let me tell you a little history. For a long time, while we were noticing things about the world, we mistakenly thought that the things that organisms are made out of is somehow chemically special compared to the things that non-living things are made out of. And that's why we coined the phrase organic. Organic material is the stuff that organisms are made out of. All right? And that stuff contains carbon. We've known this the whole time we were wrong about thinking it was special stuff. We knew there was carbon in there, and other things as well. But we thought there was something special about living material, and therefore, this is still part of the wrongness, it's impossible to take inorganic material and transform it into organic material. That's what we thought. That's wrong, though. All right. But anyway, that's the reason that the word organic exists. And also confusing is that this is entirely separate from what organic means as far as groceries are concerned. I'm talking about the scientific, the chemical definition of organic, which even as a chemical definition is still not really perfect. We've had to have some exceptions to it. But organic nowadays doesn't really have anything to do whether it's from an organism or not. We still use the word organic, but chemically speaking, organic means carbon containing, but it means more than that. So carbon containing is necessary for something to be organic, but it's not sufficient. Has to be true, but it's not enough. For instance, most of you are writing with what is mistakenly called lead. Well, they used to have pencils that used real lead. No one uses a true lead pencil anymore. It's graphite, you're right. And graphite is pure carbon. But graphite, despite containing carbon, nothing else, is not organic. Neither is diamond. If you have a diamond on you, that's also pure carbon. There's nothing but carbon atoms in there. Obviously, they're arranged a little differently, and the price is a little different.
Which would technically make the graphite in our pencils organic.
No, I just said it's not.
Oh.
And that's because carbon containing is necessary but not sufficient for organic.
Yeah.
All organic compounds have carbon, but not all carbon containing things are organic. There are a couple exceptions, like pure carbon, whether diamond, graphite, or any other pure carbon form. All right, so first of all, organic compounds are compounds. All organic materials are compounds. Pure carbon is not a compound, right? It's an element. And that's one exception to carbon containing. I mean, it's one, not really an exception, it's just a further stipulation. You have to have carbon, but you also have to have other things there, and it's almost always hydrogen is along for the ride. That's enough, by the way. Just carbon and hydrogen together gives you an organic compound. But typically there's oxygen in there as well, often nitrogen. Other things can be in there in addition. All of those things would be organic. But for historical reasons, there are also some exceptions we make that contain carbon and some other element and are still not considered organic. There's not very many exceptions, but I'm only going to tell you about one anyway for this course, which is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is not considered to be organic, even though it contains carbon and another element. Almost everything else, though, that contains carbon and some other element is organic by definition. Whether it comes from an organism or not, we just happen to call it organic because organisms are made of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and other things. Yes?
Wait, so why is water organic? But
water's not organic.
Okay, so why is
water doesn't contain any carbon at all, and therefore is not organic. So carbon containing is a necessary condition, meaning it has to be true for it to be organic, but it's not sufficient, meaning it's not enough for it to qualify as organic. The graphite of your pencil is carbon containing, but that's not enough to be organic. You also have to have other things besides carbon, with the exception of carbon dioxide. So just keep in mind for later units that carbon dioxide is officially considered inorganic. It's a little bit of an exception to the definition. Yeah.
So what are the molecules?
Well, I'm about to describe this whole thing. This setup that we're looking at in slide one is glassware that was set up this way back in the 50s in a famous set of experiments called the Miller-Urey experiments that were designed to test whether organic compounds could be produced from inorganic precursor molecules without anything living involved. And the reason this was a big question is that all organisms are organic. And we've already talked about cell theories, meaning that cells come only from pre-existing cells, but obviously there had to have been some original cells that didn't come from cells before them because there were no cells before them. So the question is, how does this happen? Cells are made out of organic compounds. Early Earth didn't really have organic compounds. Totally different place back then. For one thing, it was hot as hell compared to what we live in, which is why that first eon geographically in Earth's history was called the Hadean Eon, meaning hell-like. Totally different place chemically and thermally than it is now. But in order to have cells, of course, you have to have the molecules that cells are made out of. You have to have organic molecules. And one basic question, therefore, is where do these come from? You know, before there are any cells to make them. So they set up this experiment to mimic the early Earth conditions. Very hot. It's a water solution mimicking the oceans. Remember, that's where life started. Not on land like where we live now. And they put in the simple ingredients that they were pretty sure early Earth had plenty of. But no organic compounds. And then, because this is being heated, you have evaporation occurring. This bulb right here represents the atmosphere, what's evaporating from the seas. And it's fitted with some electrodes so that every once in a while they can hit a button and spark it to mimic lightning, which is happening, you know, intermittently in early Earth history. And you have to keep in mind that there's almost a billion years of Earth history before there was any life. A billion years is inconceivably long time from your point of view, where 30 seems old. That's nothing. A billion years, a lot can happen. So they spark it. There was plenty of lightning available, is my point. Plenty of lightning and plenty of time. But anyway, they just let it rain, and every once in a while, they would sample the water to see what's there. It didn't take long, just a couple weeks, before they had plenty of organic molecules form without any life from the precursors that were already there on Earth. So the amino acids, for instance, the proteins that all organisms are made out of, are themselves made out of. Proteins are made out of amino acids. Amino acids showed up in this. Not only amino acids, but all the amino acids that organisms use. And in fact, this was refined in the 2000s, I think, or fairly recently, maybe even more recently than that. And they did an even better job. They came up with even more amino acids than organisms use doing this. So this is one way that it can happen, but that doesn't mean it's the only way that it happened. It's also possible for organic compounds to have come from elsewhere and collided with Earth. They just brought the chemicals. You know, it could be a combination of the two. For the rest of the show, though, let's concentrate on organic compounds. This is slide 2. And what we have here are not only organic compounds, but they are relatively simple organic compounds in terms of elements involved. Remember, I said pure carbon is not organic. You have to have carbon in something else. Well, almost always something else involves hydrogen, and hydrogen is enough. So, in a sense, in terms of the number of elements involved, the simplest organic compounds are what we're looking at here, which is a subcategory of chemicals called hydrocarbons. Okay, now, hydrocarbons, as the name implies, are compounds that contain only hydrogen and carbon, nothing else. Later we'll talk about carbohydrates, which I'm sure you've heard of. Don't confuse these two words, which are similar in their roots. Carbohydrates have oxygen in them as well. Hydrocarbons contain only carbon and hydrogen, as all of these examples in this table do. The black balls here are the carbon atoms. The gray ones are the hydrogen atoms. So these are just a few of countless possible hydrocarbons that could be produced and that already exist. All right, now, this table, like any given table, has rows and columns. But in this figure, the rows show you one way of classifying hydrocarbons. There are so many different possible hydrocarbons that it's important to classify them to keep track of all of them. And the rows show you that we can classify them one way, but a totally different, independent way of classifying them is illustrated by the columns. And one way has nothing to do with the other. So, if we look at the... Forget what I was saying about rows and columns. That's not true for this figure. I'm getting my figures mixed up. These are all hydrocarbons, though. And notice that the three examples here, methane, ethane, and ethene, differ a little bit. The methane and ethane have A-N-E as their endings. They are examples of what are called alkanes. An alkane is a subset of hydrocarbons. So all alkanes are hydrocarbons, not all hydrocarbons are alkanes. But the A-N-E ending means that there is nothing but single bonds in this molecule, as you can see from these top two. Ethene, with an E-N-E ending, that's an example of an alkene, not an alkane. Still, there's nothing but carbon and hydrogen, but in order to be an alkene, you have to have at least one double bond, which this one does. All right, but so these are just examples, but let's go to the slide 3 to look at the specialness of carbon as far as valence is concerned. We've already talked about valence, and what do I mean by valence when the word is used just by itself? What is the valence of any given atom? What's the definition of valence?
The number of vacant spots for electrons to be present.
In what?
The valence shell.
In the valence shell, right. In other words, the number of additional electrons that can be taken on by that atom to fill that outer shell. That's the valence, all right? So we've already talked about the fact that the valence is one for hydrogen because it can the outer shell can only fit one more for a total of 2. 8 is the important number, though, starting with that second group. So oxygen has 6 valence electrons. Its valence, therefore, is 8 minus 2. This is all stuff we've talked about. Nitrogen has a valence of 3. And notice, by the way, nitrogen is right next to oxygen. All right on the other side of nitrogen is carbon. It has a valence of 4. Which you can say in one word by saying that carbon is tetravalent. Tetra simply means 4, like in tetrahedron. And tetravalence is a little bit special compared to the other values for valence that we see here. And that's because it allows for a much greater diversity when it comes to forming covalent bonds with other atoms. Okay, now let me just ask you, what kind of atoms are we talking about if the bonds that are forming are covalent? Yeah, nonmetals, which include hydrogen, despite it being over there on the left, remember. But it also includes carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, those things in the upper right corner, except for the noble gases, are the nonmetals. So molecules, which are structures made from covalent bonding, those all involve nonmetals. Okay, back to the tetravalence of carbon. It has a valence of 4, and so that means if it's going to be a member of a molecule, it needs to be making 4 total bonds. Because in a complete molecule, every atom has its valence satisfied. That's why the molecule forms. So in every molecule that includes oxygen, every oxygen is forming a total of 2 bonds because oxygen's valence is 2. Every hydrogen is going to be forming 1 bond, because its valence is 1. But every carbon is going to have to be forming 4 bonds. And there's more variety there possible with carbon because there's more ways that you can total 4 bonds. Hydrogen has no choice. It can form only one covalent bond, right? A single bond. So the only variety it can have is what particular type of atom it forms that single bond with. It's always a single bond, though. Carbon has 4 bonds it has to make. So part of the variety is that it can make 4 single bonds. It can make 2 double bonds, which add up to 4. Or it can make a triple bond and a single bond, which add up to 4. So there's a lot of variety just for that reason. But then when you think about making 4 single bonds, you could do that with 4 of the same thing, with 2 things, 2 bonds each, with 3 different things, or with 4 different things, all having 4 single bonds, right? And then so there's all kinds of possibilities with tetravalence compared to lower valences. That's the specialness of carbon. But carbon is not the only tetravalent atom. Remember, we talked about rows and columns. What are the columns of the periodic table called? groups, yes. And what is special about a group, the members of a group? They have similar chemical properties, exactly. Including valence, right? Oxygen has a valence of 2 because it's 2 steps from the right. Well, so does sulfur below it. Right. And so carbon is not the only tetravalent atom. Notice it's tetravalent because it's 4 steps from the right. Phosphorus is the same as nitrogen. Same valence as nitrogen because it's in the same group. Carbon is not the only tetravalent element, though. And so, what if I were to ask a kindergartner what is special on this table about the carbon among the tetravalent elements? What are the other tetravalent elements? First of all, before we answer that kindergartner question, which other ones have a valence of 4? Right, the ones in the same group, in other words.
Yeah.
Same column. Okay, so if I ask the kindergartner what is special in that column about carbon, what is the answer? That's not what a kindergartner would say. You're overthinking it. Color would be a good one. Color would be a good answer for a kindergartner, but that's not what I meant. Actually, in this one, the color doesn't change for that group. They're all black. Now you're underthinking it. It's the one at the top of the list. Is the answer. And since this is periodic table is ordered 1 through 100 and something by atomic number, right? Size of the atom. That means carbon is the smallest tetravalent element. And therefore, it's more abundant than the other ones in the universe. And so that's why we talk about carbon-based life. Life is carbon-based because carbon, because of its tetravalence, provides for a hell of a lot of possible molecules that it can make, including all the molecules, all of the organic molecules that organisms are made up of. Organisms include inorganic molecules as well, like water, you mentioned. But they include a bunch of organic compounds. Okay, now slide 4 shows you urea, which is a waste product that we animals make if we use nitrogen-containing compounds as fuel, which we usually don't. But anyway, this is... Your liver makes urea, and then urea is toxic, but not as toxic as the ammonia that would result. So we make urea instead, and then we have the kidneys deal with urea and have it be part of urine. That's actually not the point of having this slide in here. That's just what it is. It's an organic compound, though. And the reason it's here is really for historical importance. I told you before that for a long time we believed that it was chemically impossible to turn an inorganic compound into an organic compound. We believed that the only way you can get an organic compound is to get it directly from an organism. Well, now it's a routine matter to make organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. We do it all the time. But this is the first one that was done successfully. Urea was produced from inorganic sources. Rather than just getting it from urine, it was produced from inorganic sources chemically to show that we were wrong after all about that. But that defines, actually, this organic, modern definition of organic that I've given you, that is what defines the split in overall chemistry between organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry, both of which are huge sciences in their own right. Okay, now we can go to 5 and talk more about classification of hydrocarbons. Each of these, hopefully you recognize, is a hydrocarbon. Because we're looking at structural formulae here. These are structural formulae because they show you the actual carbon skeleton, which is however many carbons there are, plus whatever is attached to the carbon skeleton. All the non-carbon atoms are attached to this carbon skeleton. But they're all hydrocarbons because you see nothing but C's and H's here. No other kinds of elements. If they had other elements, they would still be organic. They just wouldn't be hydrocarbons anymore. And there's no limit to the number of hydrocarbons, as I've said. Well, one way that we can classify these to keep track of them is by the length or the size of the carbon skeleton. That's shown in A here. We have ethane and propane as two organic compounds, two hydrocarbons. Well, F means two. Prop means three. And so notice that the one called ethane is an alkane because there's nothing but single bonds in it, but the F comes from the fact that the carbon skeleton consists of two carbons. Propane consists of three, and so on. So one way of classifying is simply by how big the carbon skeleton is, how many carbons there are. Another way is shown in B, which is whether or not that carbon skeleton branches. Now, you don't get into the possibility of branching until you have at least four carbons, right? You can't form a branch point with only three or two. But as soon as you get four or more, you could have those four all lined up without branching, or you could arrange them this way with a branch, like a T. Notice that butane, the one branched one, and 2-methylpropane, the branched one, have exactly the same chemical formula. They both have exactly the same number of carbons and hydrogens. So from the chemical formula itself, you can't tell whether you're talking about butane or 2-methylpropane. A word that describes that situation of two different compounds having exactly the same chemical formula is isomer. They are isomers of each other. So don't confuse that with isotope that you might have heard of. An isotope is a different version of a same element differing in its number of neutrons. Isomers are two compounds that have the same chemical formula. All right, but anyway, we can classify alkanes, or I mean hydrocarbons, based on whether they are branched or not. Then we can worry about whether or not there are double bonds or even triple bonds. This is what I was getting at when I talked about the example table that had ethane and ethene in it. Well, here we have 1-butene and 2-butene. They are both alkenes because they end in E-N-E. The E-N-E ending tells you that you're talking about an alkene. An alkene is a hydrocarbon that has at least one double bond. These ones over here end in A-N-E because they're alkanes, no double bonds, all single bonds. But when you have four carbons or more, there's multiple possibilities for the position of the double bond. That's why 1-butene is chemically different from 2-butene. The one here indicates that it's in the first position possible, the double bond. Here it's in the second position possible. Very small difference, and they are isomers. They have the same chemical formula, but they act differently, chemically speaking, because of that difference. And then finally, we can classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not they have ringed structures. A ring is a skeleton that wraps back and connects onto itself. The carbons form a ring, in other words, and sometimes there's even more than one ring. But as opposed to these ones, which are straight chain, these ones are ringed. Cyclohexane and benzene form rings, and that affects their chemistry as well. We'll talk more about that in lab when we get to a specific example. Okay, now let's just quickly look at some very important organic compounds. First, we're looking at a fat molecule, and we'll look at the details of fats in a different chapter. We have a chapter coming up after this first test that's going to survey the major categories of biological macromolecules. And fats are lipids, lipids is one of those categories. But the reason that fats are shown here is because a fat, which can also be called a triglyceride, is a four-part structure. You have this part where all of it is connected. That's a glycerol. We'll relearn this later. And then connected to that glycerol are three fatty acids. The combination of all four of those is a fat. And the fatty acid tails of these, as you can see in these ball and stick models, is nothing but carbons and hydrogens, except for the very end where it connects. The length of the tail, if it were just by itself, that would be a hydrocarbon, right? Nothing but carbon and hydrogen. Well, hydrocarbons, like the propane and the ethane and the other examples shown in the previous slide, those hydrocarbons make for excellent fuels. For instance, the automobiles that unfortunately are still burning fossil fuels, gasoline, are taking advantage of the fact that hydrocarbons are excellent fuels. There's a lot of chemical energy locked up in carbon-hydrogen bonds. That's why hydrocarbons in general make good fuels that we can burn industrially, like to make a car go down the road or to heat a house. But within organisms, the same is true. There's a lot of chemical energy locked up in the carbon-hydrogen bonds in a fat, which is why when we store extra energy, because we take in more food than we actually need at the moment, whatever it comes in as doesn't matter. We're going to turn it into fat for storage because it's efficient storage. It packs a lot of energy into a small space. Seven. Now let's talk more about isomers that I've already introduced you to as a definition. There are more than just three, but we're looking at three categories of isomers in this slide. There's only three for this course that you need to worry about. And those are structural isomers, geometric isomers, and enantiomers. Now, structural isomers are the easiest to understand. We've already talked about them a little bit in the previous slide. Structural isomers are isomers are isomers that differ only in the shape of their carbon skeleton. Right? Pentane is pentane because it has five carbons. That's what pent means, five. But 2-methylbutane also has five. These are isomers, and therefore they have identical chemical formulae. They're both C5H12. But pentane has an unbranched carbon skeleton, whereas methylbutane has a branched one, and that makes it a different chemical, despite the same chemical formula. So those are structural isomers. Notice that those are possible for alkanes, only single bonds. Geometric isomers, as a category, doesn't make sense unless you're talking about something that has at least one double bond in it. And in today's lab, you're playing with ball and stick models to represent molecules. And what you'll see firsthand, but you'll just have to picture right now, is that if you have a single bond, which would be a stick between two wooden balls, the wooden balls are the atoms, if it's a single bond, then you can swivel those atoms, right? But if you have a double bond, you can't swivel it. It locks it in place, keeps it from swiveling. Just like in these two examples here. Now, these aren't real examples because X is not actually an element. It's not on the periodic table. It just means anything other than hydrogen here. These two are hydrogen. These two are anything else. Well, if you have a double bond between the two carbons, you're going to lock it either into this configuration or, by forming the bond differently, into this configuration, in which the X's are not on the same side, they're on opposite sides. So there's two possible, even though they're shaped the same, there's two possible isomers for this. And we call the two possibilities cis, C-I-S, and trans, T-R-A-N-S. Same prefaces that we use for gender words now. Cisgender and transgender, for instance. Cis means same side. Trans means across or other side. Okay? And then the most complex of the three that you need to know are the enantiomers. Enantiomers come into play when a carbon, which remember, all carbons are tetravalent. They have to be making four bonds. When a carbon is forming four single bonds to satisfy its valence, Plus, in addition to that fact, the four bonds are with four different kinds of things. Then you have enantiomers possible. We can see that here. The four corners, which are the four things the carbon is bonded to, those are four different atoms in this case. If they were all hydrogen, then every version would be the same. There's only one way that you can make a carbon with four hydrogens on it, ball and stick wise. But if the four things are different, then what you have made is an example of what is called a chiral compound. Chiral is the adjective, we would say the trait is chirality. Chirality means handedness. Chiro means hand. Like in the words chiropractor, someone who works on you with his or her hands. Chiromancer uses hands to cast spells, and so on. So chirality means having handedness, meaning there is a left-handed version and a right-handed version, just like real hands. That's why the hands are shown here. Now your hands, when you look at them, are very, very similar to each other. Within the same body, within the same individual, the two hands are usually very, very similar. But think about your hand, and we can't go through with this, but just imagine hacking your hands off so that you just have them in front of you to play with.
And then growing a new.
Of course, you'd have to have new. You have to have new hands in order to play with them. But anyway, if you look at your hand in isolation, the right one, there is no way that you can pick that up and turn it around in space to make it into your left one. They are mirror images of each other. That's a similarity, but they're not the same, right? Which is why you have to have two different kinds of gloves to fit properly. You put your right hand into a left-handed glove, it's not the same. Well, it would be for surgical gloves, but not for tailored gloves. All right? And that happens when you have carbon bonded to four different things. If you make this ball and stick model that's shown on the left here, this L isomer, just like your hand, there's no way you could pick up this model and turn it around and put it on the table and make it look like this one on the right. The only way you could do it is if you break two bonds and form two new bonds. In other words, switch the balls around. That's the only way you could make the mirror image. So this is the same compound, but there's two versions of the compound. A left-handed version and a right-handed version. That's what enantiomers are. Left and right-handed versions of isomers. And notice that these isomers are labeled as L version and D version. The L stands for levo, which means left, and the D for dextro, which means right. One of the ways in which the majority of humans, which are right-handed people, aren't fair to the left-handed people of the world is with the form dextro. We say that someone is dexterous, which literally means right-handed, if they work well with their hands. If they work well with either hand, they can do things with either hand, right and left. We don't use a word that gives credit to their left-handedness. We say they are ambidextrous, which means having two right hands. Because we say right is correct. Well, it's not, obviously. Left-hand people are in the minority as far as the human population overall is concerned, but it's just one of two possibilities. Anyway, that's what the L version comes from. And you see this a lot in drug names, like L whatever versus D whatever. In fact, I think probably the next slide shows you some of this. Actually, no, this is a different standard. Slide 8 shows you why chirality matters. When we talked about chemical signals, in a previous slideshow, the one with what was the drug? Oh yeah, morphine. Thanks. Remember that I said that any given chemical signal will have no effect in an organism unless it's able to bind to a particular receptor that has the right shape to receive it. If that binding doesn't happen, the cell has no idea the chemical signal's there and nothing will happen. Well, drugs are chemical signals. And so pharmaceutical companies spend a big part of their budget after advertising researching ways that they can come up with molecules as drugs that mimic the effects that endogenous signals in our bodies produce. In order to do that, they have to have the right shape. Well, a lot of times these molecules are chiral, which means there's two possibilities for the substance. It can be either the L version or the D version. That's one standard notation, left-handed version or right-handed version. Another standard that they use is the S and R. S stands for sinistro as a combining form, but as a word by itself, it would be sinistral, which means left-handed. This is another way we are cruel to the left-handers of the world. The word sinister is used to describe someone who you better be suspicious of because that person is left-handed looking, is what it literally means. But anyways, the S here means the left-handed version, and R means recto, which means right, like in rectangle, right angles. But what you see on these examples here is that there is no correct version universally. It's on a signal-by-signal basis. The receptor is like the glove, right? The signal is like the hand. Well, whatever the glove is dictates what kind of hand has to be there to work. And if the body has left-handed receptors, then only the left-handed version of the drug will work. In this case, ibuprofen, the effective version, the effective enantiomer, is the S version, is the left-handed version, because the receptors in the body happen to be left-handed. The right-handed version exists. You can produce it in the lab, but it won't do anything to the body because the body won't recognize it. It's just the reverse for albuterol. The right-handed version is the effective one. The left-handed one does nothing. Yeah? Yes, but not because of chirality. There's multiple ways that you can get tolerance, one of which is, and the same thing happens, even though it's not called drug tolerance, in insulin resistance, which is a huge problem because of the American diet. What happens in a lot of cases is if there is too much signal, cells respond by taking in some of those surface receptors that are there at the ready, making fewer of them available so that the effect of an overdose is not as strong. And that's one way that that you can get drug resistance is by down-regulation of the actual receptors. Did you also have a question?
Yeah, I wonder why S is an SNR if you have the R and D as the chemistry.
They are not exactly the same thing. It's beyond the scope of this course, but it depends on how they determine whether they're right or left-handed. In some cases, it's because of what happens to light that they shine on it. Other cases, it's because of how the actual ball and stick model is made, so they've given different names to them. But S always corresponds, it's always left-handed, so it would be another version of L in the other system of classification, and R is a different version of D. Did you have one? I saw another hand. Oh, yeah.
So in the case of ibuprofen, are both types released? Or is it that the receptor changes to what it
means? Well, ibuprofen is a drug, so it's not produced in the body. It's purchased from pharmaceutical companies. And they could produce the R version. It would just be a waste of their money. Because if you put this into the body, no effect. And that's because it won't fit into the left-handed receptors, just like a right hand won't fit into a left-handed glove. So drugs, which are actually manufactured items, are intentionally made to be the correct version only. Otherwise, they'd be wasting money. Yeah.
My apologies, I know it's too far back, but so are enantiomers, they have to be the same. They can't be structural isomers, right?
Right. They're isomers still, but they're classified differently because it's not just a rearrangement of the carbon skeleton. It's actually what's connected to the carbon that matters.
I see. They have to be the same, structure.
Any isomers have to be identical in their chemical formulae. But enantiomers are different from each other because they're mirror images of each other. That's what makes them enantiomers. All right, let's go to the laboratory.